Hi, my name is Hans Peter Meyer, and you're listening to the Lift Startups podcast series, all about the entrepreneurs, creatives, and small businesses who are growing the next economy on Vancouver Island.
You who've been listening, we've just been talking to Jayesh Parmar, CEO and founder of Pick-A-Tick, talking about Pick-A-Tick. But this segment here, we're going to be talking, we've got some questions for you about you as an entrepreneur and as a human being. So what's your favorite thing about the work you're doing today?
There's so many. That's such a great question, Hans. Right now, that's really driving me is movement. Just seeing the events that are coming on there in terms of what type of change people are making within their own communities, and knowing that we have a small part in helping that bridge together is really, really, really inspiring and fun. And then another favorite thing, I think, is really the talent and the people that we have inside of our team, and seeing these beautiful humans and their talents collide together and create magnificent pieces of work, and it's really inspiring. So really, it's getting to be a small part of great events and create a little bit of change, and also being a small part of our team and helping lead great leaders to go out there and do phenomenal work with the Pick-A-Tick platform.
What are three things that people don't know about your business?
The API for sure would be the number one is that the API is, I guess, you know, for people who aren't familiar with an API, it's a software solution. So if I had to put it sort of an analogy again for people, is that you just imagine an iceberg, and an iceberg is this big engine under, or big piece of ice underneath the waterline, but you only see the top in a smaller piece on the top. Effectively, if we cut off the top, we just leave you with the bottom, and you can build anything you want on top. That's what an API does. So you can build your own infrastructure. It's your brand, your identity. You can integrate other APIs inside, just other partners and software. So that is that people don't know. I think movement is the next thing. It's because we're so grassroots with that initiative in terms of that. And then I guess the third thing that people don't know is that we're Canadian, and our team is most people think our team is probably a few hundred maybe or much larger than it is. I think that's something that's pretty neat, is that how capital efficient and how efficient we are with our resources in order to go out there and build what we have built.
So, and you're right now, you're telling me only about 18 people.
That's right. That's I mean, 18 people. And then comparatively, when you look at us, and there's a lot of review software sites out there in the world and all that kind of stuff. And we are listed right there at the very top of the world's best. And when you start taking a look at how much money and how many people that they have in with their softwares, we definitely punch above our weight. But I mean, that's a competitive advantage. We take a look at that as being able to move faster. We're not so bulky, and that's what's been able to go out there and give us the speed that we're able to go out there and compete at this level at.
Okay, now back to you personally. So what was your biggest failure and what did it teach you?
Oh, that is just first and foremost is I failed. Failure is just a data point. And I think failure is really only if I continue to keep on doing the same thing over or dwell in it. So, I don't consider failure to be failure. I think is just a learning opportunity. And as mentioned, a data point. And now, how many data points have I failed at? Tremendously. Like, but now it's just like it's ironic. It's like we're trying to fail, but fail fast, fail cheap, and iterate as fast as we possibly can. The biggest failures that we have in the past one beautiful one that's really epic is that we decided to go out there and and pivot our platform to crowdfunding for events. So really back when crowdfunding was this big and big initiative, there's a lot of like a lot of crowdfunding platforms, and we thought, oh, we're on events, it'd be perfect. And the reason being is because event organizers, when they're putting on an event, there's a lot of upfront capital. They have to go out there and, you know, book the band, book the music, book the hall, et cetera, and all this capital. And that's before they've even sold one single ticket or know if anybody's even remotely interested in coming to their event. So we're like, okay, well, if there is these event organizers, let's let them crowdfund it, meaning that they can entice buyers, early adopter buyers, to come purchase for their event at a discounted price, knowing that they have to reach a certain amount of critical mass before the event goes on. If the event doesn't go on, they get their money back. So they're protected. And the organizer knows that, okay, well, there's these early adopters, and they have enough people to hit this mass that the event will be successful, and they got great market validation. Now, as a whole, in the software and the idea, it's fantastic. It worked phenomenally well. The problem, and where we epically failed, is that, for example, let's say you live in Toronto and you have this big event, but now you want to go out there and get market validation in New York. The first year you get market validation is great, and you're like, great, we crowdfunded it and it worked. But the second year, you don't need to crowdfund it because you've already got validation. So our lifetime value of our customer was not big, meaning that when we got a customer, they would only stay with us for one event and then be gone. And when you start looking at in terms of building a business around 100% churn, it didn't really work out, and it was a massive failure for us. We iterated, we pivoted, and we were able to go out there and get our business to where it needed to be.
Have mentorship or community played a role in your personal success?
Oh, 100%, 1,000 times, and the mentorship comes in so many different ways. You know, younger, older, you know, vertical specific. It's really in terms of the founder psychology or entrepreneur psychology, in terms of, you know, the roller coaster that we go through. But I would love to share this one story. I'm not sure if I have shared it, but there's this one mentorship piece of advice that was given to us, and it lasted, you know, the mentorship session lasted about 5 minutes, and it effectively saved our company from what I think would have crashed and burned many years ago. And it went like this. We were from Saskatoon, we went to San Francisco and then Toronto, and then we were in New York, and we raised a bit of money, we need to go out there and find a head office in terms of where we wanted to go out there and make Pick-A-Tick HQ. And most of our money came from the Eastern Seaboard. So it was natural for our investors to want us to stay on that side and just have close proximity. But being from Saskatchewan and sort of the West Coast kind of style guys, we gravitated more towards San Francisco, or, you know, back to Saskatoon, or maybe even Vancouver, or wherever it is. So the team got together, and we sat, and we were round tabling, and one of the investors walked in and just said, hey, what type of problems are you solving today? What's going on? You know, what's the lowdown? And we said, hey, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out where we're going to go out there and move our office. And he's like, okay, great. And started talking about it. And just went, whoa, wait a second. Have you guys talked to your wives or fiancés or your partners? And unanimously all of us were like, no, we haven't chatted about this. And he effectively called us idiots. In a tongue-in-cheek way, and said, go home, talk to your partners, because if you don't have that support, you have nothing. Now that we've gone through the roller coaster that we have, if we didn't have the supportive partners that we had, there would be nothing. And that 5 minutes of advice, we took it back to our partners unanimously. Everyone was okay, we want to be in Vancouver. And you know, as they say, happy wife, happy life, happy partner, happy life. In that case, we made the right decision. And that piece of 5 minutes saved our company, what otherwise would have been a defunct company a long time ago.
Good one. Who was your most important hire, and why was that?
I think it's funny. It's like it's a hire, but I mean, as an entrepreneur, and you know, I was the founder, The founding member of this is your first drive is to go out there and find co-founders. So as you go out there and you look for co-founders, I think like is you're really trying to find, and that's like a marriage in terms of making sure that you can find people that who's going to go out there and ride this roller coaster with you, and et cetera, have the same vision, have the same passion, be able to go out there and have skill sets that are much greater than yours, and you guys can complement each other. So I think the most important hire, and I don't necessarily think it's a hire, but partner at that time, because, and I guess hire, it's because at that time we had no money. We're in it together, and it's been like that ever since. We're in it together, but is my co-founder Brett Eid, and you know, without question. This could not have be what it is without a strong co-founder like him. And that is the most important person throughout this organization, with me. And so that one is an easy one to answer.
Okay. Are you a reader?
I am. Yeah, I am when I have time. It's a lot of audiobooks mostly now.
Okay, well, that counts. What was your favorite book as a child?
Anything by Robert Munsch. Yeah, oh. I love Robert Munsch. I mean, anything by Robert Munsch is, and it's just funny. I have a 4.5-year-old child now, so I'm getting reintroduced to Paperback Princess and Robert Munsch, and it brings back good memories. So, and I love reading. I love reading it to this day as an adult.
As an adult, what has been your favorite book? If you can name one or two to this point.
The hard things about hard things, I mean, that's an easy one to rip off. I mean, and the reason being is just goes to the founder psychology and just realizing that, you know, this is a tough gig, and when you're trying to build something that has no real roadmap and you're going through it, there's going to be hurdles and all the other stuff, and knowing that, you know, you're not by yourself, and this is just all part of the journey, and that's fun to read about that. And then another one is from a local author that I'm diving into right now and reading, is it's called Early Exits by Basil Peters. He's a Vancouver-based author. That's been a really, really great read in terms of wrapping my eye around the business side of the venture capitalist market, or the VC and the angel market. So that's really interesting, and I'm having some fun learning some key points around his points and his thoughts in his book.
Okay. What is the smartest thing you think you've ever done?
marry my wife. I think the smartest thing is really going out there. Listen, is getting out of my comfort zone. There's no question about this. The smartest thing is moving out of Saskatoon, and not that Saskatoon, I love it. It's home, and I'll retire there. And that is my heart. And that is, like, you know, it's a community that grew me into who I am. And I feel like I owe a lot back to it. But getting outside of that comfort zone, I had a really comfortable, very, very secure life. And not until I was pushed out of that, I realized that, there's a lot of learnings. And throughout that process is, once I got out of that comfort zone, there is panic attacks, there is discomfort, there is just sleepless nights, there is just a ton of just agony around that. And the lesson it taught me, which is why I think it's the smartest thing, is that comfort zones are just an illusion anyways. I mean, we really don't have much control over it. But what I did find is that the greatest learning that I've had as a human, as a person, as an individual, as a partner, came when I was pushed out of that comfort zone, which now has really became my new comfort zone, is uncomfortability. And I think that as a whole is an investment in myself as a person. And I think that's the smartest thing that I've done. And moreover, that the lesson that I will be able to go out there and teach my child at someday is, I didn't sit in the cheap seats. Not saying that if anybody doesn't do this, so they're sitting in the cheap seats, just for myself, is I really went after it and I swung. And now if it wins or if it loses, it doesn't matter. But I showed up and I swung, and I keep on swinging. And because of that, there has been some success.
Well, and conversely, what's the dumbest thing you've ever done?
You know, it's the that whole stick your tongue on a pole in wintertime. You know, like the dumbest thing, the analogy on that is really not taking a second and stop and asking for advice from people who have been there, done that. And I think it's just been lazy. Is really staying safe in my zone. So when have you
done that? Give me an example.
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I should have left the company. I was playing around with the company 5 years, and it was within the comfort zone. It was a side project. We really didn't push it out. I think effectively is that we should have gone, you know, year one, year two. And gone with that. So that's one thing that we could have done is like we've lost many years in competitive advantage, I think, around that. There's too many dumb things to really, like bad hires, hiring when we shouldn't have hired. Well, inversely, some of the best things we've done is great hires. Just a ton of small mistakes that have added into, and some real big mistakes, but none are really coming to mind outside of the ones that we mentioned.
So you talked about, you know, getting out of your comfort zone, and this next question is about the scariest thing you've ever done. But how did you get through some of this anxiety? How did you get through some of the fear that you've faced?
Oh, you know what? I mean, I'm going to be as transparent as I possibly can. It's not easy. I mean, in Saskatchewan, I mean, effectively retired, everything was easy. And then coming out here, down to the valley, I equated to this. And just to give you some context, is being a phenomenal hockey player, just like really awesome in Guatemala, and then coming up to Canada and the kids that play on the street are better than you. When I went to the valley, that's what I learned, is like just everyone was smarter. The Harvard kids, the Stanford kids, just everyone is just faster, smarter, harder, faster. And so getting over it is really taking humility, understanding that this is just a process, and what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And so it's just really getting up every single day and going after it and going after it and going after it and going after it and having no quit. And then also understanding that, you know, there's learning is like these people know more. What do they know that you don't, and trying to find that information and learn. So investing the time in order to go out there and get yourself at that speed is critical. And the difference between some and others is some people will just pack up, take their ball home, and they'll take their licks and it'll be like, okay, I tried, where the others will be like, okay, I'm going to get beat up and go and go and go and go until I find it. And so there is no easy answer to that other than just getting up and going, and just getting up and going and just getting up and going and continually driving to a point. Yeah. So it's hard work.
Now this is the Tim Ferriss podcast series. It's something that has inspired this my podcast series, and so this question actually comes from Tim Ferriss, and that is, what new belief, behavior, or habit adopted within the last 5 years is having the most positive impact in your life today?
Is okay. For tons, lots. I mean, the belief is failure is just a data point, plain and simple. That is it. I don't romance failure, but I wear like a badge of honor on my side of my shirt. And I understand like that when I talk about failure, I'm proud of my failures because it's helped me iterate and learn from them. That's probably the utmost first and foremost. And then, you know, the people aspect is just your understanding is that in order to build good companies, good platforms, good ideas, is really trying to go out there and find great people, and get out of their way and try and bring out the best of people. And so from a management side, is really working with different principles around that, and getting out of my own way, and getting out of my own ego, and really, really, really making sure that people who are part of the team are leading the way.
If you could have a conversation with someone who died before you were born, who would that be, and what would you talk about?
I haven't really thought about anybody who I'd like to. I mean, I'm fascinated by JFK. I'm fascinated by old presidents, which is unique. I'm fascinated by Gandhi. I know who it would be without is somebody who has died, and I actually went and visited Robben Island a few months back in South Africa is Nelson Mandela. I would love to go out there and talk about perseverance and being humility and leading by example and playing the long game and never giving up. And I just want to talk about what was it like? How did you get through 27 years of working in the mines and being on this island and still having the mindset, the cognition, and being able to be a leader and still at the end be president of your country? And how did you bring all these people together? Just the psychology around that, because when I think about hardship in terms of what we've gone through in terms of running a business, they pale exponentially to what that man went through in terms of really bringing our pride tide and bringing a country together, and getting that country to where it is right now. And it's not perfect by any means, don't get me wrong, but there's some great leadership around that, and I'd love to have a conversation with him because he was able to bring some great change a whole nation. That's a very inspiring.
Okay. So we're based on Vancouver Island, so I'm always asking this Vancouver Island question. I don't think you're all that familiar with the island, are you?
No, I mean, I've been there about a handful of times. Every time I go out there, I'm always amazed with what I see, what I've learned. One of my best lessons actually in life came from Vancouver Island at a beautiful winery tour that I was at. And it was very interesting, but yeah, it's a great community, and the people are outrageously kind and nice.
So what is one thing, from what you know about Vancouver Island, what is one thing that every Vancouver Islander should do this year, something that most of us maybe don't know about or appreciate the value of?
I think it's just like anybody who's local, they sometimes don't appreciate their own backyard and explore something new. My wife and I, we go, when we ever go to the islands, we have to try something new because there's so many pockets in different parts of the island. I think that people who are in the island, I think that they would be surprised how many beautiful things that they have in their backyard. Generally, we tend to go out there and travel outside of our own backyards. And that was akin to what we were in Saskatchewan, is that there's so much happening in Saskatchewan that we could spend years just exploring our own backyard. So the only advice I'd give to anybody inside their own communities is just go out there and explore a little bit more in their backyards for what it's worth.
So what was the last thing you discovered on Vancouver Island?
I mean, because for us, we just think it's such a, and it's maybe it's because it's foreign to us, but every time we go from, like, oh, I love Airstreams, and there's this Airstream camp, and I think I can't remember where it is, but there's Airstream camp with this beautiful coffee, and I know the owner's name is Mike, and we got to meet him. We spent Canada Day at this resort. We've gone to Gambier Island, and we do that every year, so that's just something that we do. We've gone down the winery tours out there. There's just so much, and that is out there that you can do, and it's so peaceful. There's just all these nooks and crannies. I don't know. Would you agree that there's a lot of nooks and crannies out there that are just ready to be discovered?
Yeah, I would agree. And I'm trying to illuminate some of them for other people and for myself too. So I'm always asking. So here's a totally non question, like a very different kind of question. If someone gave you $1 million to support local entrepreneurs, I want you to be fairly specific about this. What three things would you
do? I think there's one thing that I do and have compartments of A, B, and C, but of local entrepreneurs is that there's the thing that I do is I'd go out there and put that risk capital back into the ecosystem. So angel investing. And I'd spread that out is making sure, because like the risk capital at the beginning in terms of really sparking the creation idea on a piece of paper or a minimal viable product, banks aren't going to fund that. It needs to come from angels. So I'd love to put that inside there. The second thing that I'd do is I'd create an organization called Dog Fooding. I'm not sure. Thank you for asking this question, because it's something that I still think I would like, want to do is dog fooding is the sense of in educating the community to go out there, and if they can't invest dollars, but invest time into early products that these your local sons and daughters are building within their community. And the reason being is because at the beginning, startups and the products are crap. They're awful. And you should be embarrassed about your product every 6 months. But the only way, and you don't want to spend so much money building it, because you might be polishing up something that is completely useless. And so the only way to really get that iterative feedback is to go out there and have early adopters or friendlies use it, phone you up and tell you that, oh, this is this product. You know, you might want to do this, or you might want to change that. And that's really helped. Like when we're in Saskatchewan, even in Vancouver now, people will call us up and they'll give us their feedback, and they'll eat their own dog food. They'll support their own community. Now we've got to a point where we're much larger, but at the beginning, our product is crap. It was awful. It was, you know, and looking back at it, we're embarrassed about it, but that proudly embarrassed about it. So the thing we'll do is invest in these startups to go out there and build their products first. Again, they're going to be crap, and they're going to get, you know, they're going to be less crappier and crappier as they go along. And then in educate the public to go out there and use them and support them. And the reason why that's important is the why is because what it does is it helps spring up the next beautiful company in your own backyard. Two, once they get going like us, they start hiring people that are in tech and that aren't in tech. And so that's a new taxation base, which builds sidewalks and helps the ecosystem and the community. And third is that they bring in new money. So once they get to a certain level, they start bringing outside investment dollars within our ecosystem. So it's not recycled money, it's new money. And then once they exit, they now then can go out there and reinvest back into the community, but not just money, but they can do it also with experience, so they can add value add. So that's that whole small little ecosystem and that nuance that we want to go out there and help educate and build. And I think it's important to build up good startup ecosystems or good technology ecosystems that can compete. And again, we are competing with the rest of the world, bar none, plain and simple. And so the faster and the better that we can go out there and support our own, the more successful we will be as a community moving forward, because everything inevitably is going to be tech.
Okay. What is something or some things quirky or unknown, something that people don't know about you? Because, yeah. Just tell us something that we might not know about you, Jay.
In terms of quirkiness, I think maybe there's a lot, but some people might not know. Is that
maybe we should ask your
wife?
Yeah,
absolutely. Something. Sometimes when people are surprised and they don't know, and I don't often share this, but I was an elementary school teacher for 12 years. I taught kindergarten to grade 4 phys ed.
Wow. Yeah. And all this time you're being a DJ and you're growing this ticketing company.
Yeah. And, yeah. I had on the side and did that. And I mean, had a petroleum construction company, commercial property, residential. So a whole bunch of different things. And at the end of my career, I was only teaching for a few hours a day. And so to run business, and it was quite a unique environment and situation and extremely supportive. But, yeah, that was a pretty quirky thing, and it was neat. It was very, very. It was something that I cherish, and And I plan to retire back to a substitute teacher someday. And so that's
in an elementary.
That's right. The idea is that my son, I'd love to go in and be a sub teacher for their class, and I don't care to get paid, just to give the teacher a little bit of prep time, which they'll love, and I get to come in and maybe, you know, teach a few hours and do that until my son thinks I'm not cool anymore, and then go to the next chapter.
Okay. This is the last question that we have for you, or I have for you. What's your favorite place to eat in the whole world?
It's not open anymore, but listen, I know what I'm going to go, and I know that the team knows this, and it has an island connection, so I'm proud to say this, but in Gastown, there is the ultimate burrito, and it's a chicken burrito from Tocofino. It is probably the best thing the team knows that is my weakness. And I love that, like nobody's business. So that's probably one of my favorite things. Especially because it has an island connection.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Jay, for taking the time to talk.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for sharing our story.
And for everybody who's listening, I've been talking to Jay Ashparmar. He's the founder and CEO of Pick a Tick, and you'll find him online at picatic.com. Talk to you soon, Jay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Good morning, Jay.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
And hi, everybody who's listening. Today, I'm talking with Jay Ashparmar, founder and CEO of Pick a Tick. Jay, tell us about Pick a Tick. What is it?
Pick a Tick is an online ticketing and event management company. We help event organizers host, plan, manage their events. We do it a little bit differently in the sense that they can come out there and do it themselves. But on top of that, we give them opportunities to go out there and embed links, widgets, code onto their own assets. So for example, if they want to put them to their website or if they want to put them in their app, so it makes it feel like they have their own white labeled experience. It's their brand, their story, their customer. In addition, what we do is we integrate into third-party channels like Slack and a whole bunch of other channels where the buyers or the end users or their customers can go out there and purchase wherever their tribe lives, so they're not redirected, and just helps bring more people to their events and helps events become more successful. And that's the great things that we get to do is help bring people
together. You talked about some of the features there, but there are a number of event apps out there, ticketing apps. What do you think makes Pick a Tick unique or innovative?
Yeah, dramatically different than our competitors is that gone are the days where we want to have people come to your brand or your event, maybe your asset, your website, and then click a link and then redirect it onto another page. For example, go to X company, X ticketing company. And then what ends up happening is that it's more about the ticketing company and their brand outside of yours. So when you start looking at the data, there's a lot of lost conversions and meaning that people don't purchase. What we've done is we've done it completely different in the sense that we're not about our brand. We're all about your brand. We integrate within your infrastructure. You know, you don't need to have any technical skills. You can just copy and paste code. And then on top of that is rather than having the user come to us, we want to go to them. So instead of asking the user even to come to your own website is how do we go to, you know, Facebook where they can purchase in there? How do we go to Slack where they can purchase in those channels where they live? So it's a completely different vantage point in terms of not about us, more about you. And then also we don't touch any of the dollars. The dollars go directly straight to you. That helps you have working capital. So for every 2 days in the States, in different parts of the world, or the maximum 7 days, that money's trickling in. So event organizers can use that as working capital. And then lastly, we have this API. So brands, enterprise, multinationals can build on top of our platform. So if there's anybody that wanted to effectively build their own ticketing company, or they want to integrate different features with inside their infrastructure, they can do that with our API. So it's really development centric and focused. So that makes us completely different. And there's just a plethora of other things that we have because of our API that we can now offer our users that completely change the
How
game.
long have you been working on this?
Well, the interesting question. It's been a side project for me back in the day for about 5 years. We got accepted to an accelerator in 2013, so about 5 years now, where we took some funding and we built out the team and did it at a full time plus hours. So, the question is it's been a 10-year project. 5 years of it where it was like, okay, full time, we're gonna dive in deep and really try and push this to the rest of the world, and that's exactly what has happened.
Cool. But you started before you went big. It started as something. Tell me a bit about the backstory. I think that's really interesting how you got into this.
Sure. I mean, it started because I mean, the back story, and really quickly, is a buddy of mine. We were 20 years old. We were working at a clothing store. There was a sidewalk sale in Saskatchewan, of all places. We as a sidewalk sale, that's effectively all the clothing gets pushed out into the hallways or in the mall. And us being 20, we were effectively pseudo security guards. We folded clothes all day and we made sure that nothing was went missing. So we had a lot of time to talk. The discussion went around is like, well, if we could have our dream, and again, note that we're 20 years old, what would we like to do? And our idea at that time was meet girls, party, get paid to have some beers, and do that. So that was the problem that we wanted to solve at that time. We got this BDC loan. BDC had a student loan for $3,000. We applied for it. We got it. We went and bought a whole bunch of DJ equipment. That led to us getting some press, a whole page article on us that then our colleges at our university hired us. So we went from making $50 a day to $500. And then we started putting on our own events, and then we started doing $5,000 events, and then we were doing events for the Prime Minister, Wayne Gretzky, Gene Simmons, all these celebrities. And then that led us to building out our own ticketing company, which then got the attention of some people in the Valley. They invited us to come down there, and that's when we really realized that, okay, we got to put this in full effect and full force, and there's something here. And then so we went and applied to an accelerator and another one, and got some learning, some education, some foundation, raise some money, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Why are you so passionate about what you're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a quadruple bottom line, and it's integrated into the DNA. First and foremost, I mean, it's people. People love people, love humanity, love our time on this earth. So just passionate about people and their stories, and what makes them what them. Secondly, most importantly, and you'll see it all over our site and our branding and entwined in everything that we do, it's bring people together. That is a privilege in terms of my world, in terms of how I think. Meeting new friends, meeting old friends, maybe the love of your life. For me, it's my son. He's he when he was in preschool, I got to see him had his Christmas concert for the first time. Those are things that money can't buy. That's life. That's culture. That's community. And we get to do that day in, day out, and help facilitate bringing people together. And so that's a big passion. And the next thing is community. Is we just launched Movement where we're trying to raise $100 million for the better needs of communities all over the world. And through software and through our platform, we feel that we can go out there and make a social impact, or to communities around the world. So that's what really drives me and our team in order to go out there and use their skills in order to go out there and help bring people together and potentially make the world a better place. So that's our passion, and that's our reason of why we do what we do.
Yeah, so I mean, I'd like to hear more about the movement. I mean, you've talked a bit about it, but so how did that come about? So you've called this thing, is it Picatinny movement or the movement, or what is it?
Yeah. Okay, so I'll give you some backstory on that one. About a year and a half ago, maybe a little bit more, an event organizer came to me and they wanted to go out there and have me sponsor one of their events, and it was a fundraising event, and so the organizer called and said, would you make this donation? And I was like, well, what is it for? And he explained, he's like, well, we're raising money for these kids to buy instruments. Their current instruments are made out of trash and recycled material as they live in Central America. And to me, my first world, I didn't even realize that was even a thing. So I Googled it and looked, and sure enough, there are people out there that put instruments together because they have nothing. And it really, talk about making lemonade out of lemons. So went and met with their organizing team because I got really invested in terms of the story and realized that they're only raising $6,000. They're doing a concert event, and I was like, well, with our software, with my knowledge, I can help. And rather than making donation, is why don't we try and raise $30,000? I'm happy to say that we raised over $30,000, and then it got me thinking. I was like, well, like, there's a lot of people who are trying to go out there and raise money, do special events, just selfless people that are looking to meet the needs, the better needs of people within their community, but they're just not event organizers. They don't have the skills because they do what they do, their jobs. So I was like, I talked to the team, came back and put a little side page. And I said, if there's any organizers that come in that are making change in their communities, change makers, nonprofits, charitable organizations, have them come onto this little page and we'll sponsor their event in terms of their piece. So it was a test. I didn't know if it was going to work or not. And we said, no, we'll give it a year test. And $5 million later, we realized we had something, and which is great because we're making money in all over the world, but how do we go out there and make impact or leave the place better than what we found it? So this is a good way to kind of do that. So a little bit of a self-serving in terms of that intrinsic feel on our part. But the problem with this happened was that they'd have to apply, and we would then became these adjudicators of who gets the sponsor rate, who doesn't. And that's not what we wanted to do. We didn't want to really create a bottleneck. So the idea came to create a movement and really go out there and swing hard. And so the idea is if we can raise $5 million, why can't we raise $100 million? And then the idea came as how do we make this open sourced? Meaning that people don't have to apply. They can just log in, they can self-identify, and then maybe what we could do is we could have the community police it, if you will, or self police it. So what we did is we created these pages in this program or this initiative called Movement, where anybody who considers themselves a nonprofit change maker, just helping their community's greatest needs, they can come on. They identify. They don't have to talk to a single person. We don't need any sponsorship from them. We need nothing from them. They come on. When they go live with their event, there's a header, meaning the top of the website talks about what Movement is. And on the footer, there is a community gathering of how much money we have raised collectively in the world. So there's this online counter. And I guess the idea around that is bold initiatives bring in bold people. And we want to keep fairly transparent in terms of, what this initiative is doing. And so that has worked really, really well in terms of people have really gravitated it, and we've taken away the barriers. And so it's been in full force, and in the last few months we've raised another $3 million or $4 million. Wow. So we're slowly itching to the $100 million mark. There will be a tipping point. The one thing that we have done is we won't use any type of paid marketing or anything like that. The inside the team, we want to be really authentic and genuine. If the world takes it, they use it, great. This is not something where we're trying to get any type of press or anything of that sort. We just really want it to be a tool for people. So it's in the background, and people are slowly getting aware of it. And when they do, they're really happy. And there's a wonderment in the sense of like, what's the hook? What's the gimmick? You know, is this really what it is? And we're like, yeah, go for it. So a lot of great success so far with it.
Well, we've really benefited from your support here at Lyft and on Vancouver Island. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, and fantastic.
I've always like your attitude and your approach to stuff has been inspiring for what we're doing here for sure. So it's all pretty obvious who your target market is for Movement, but who's your target audience or market for Picketing? Like, who do you want to get in front of?
Yeah, great. I mean, that's a good question. And we have a huge taxonomy in terms of users that can use this, and we haven't really marketed our product at all. We just spent the last quarter really taking a look in that data and really focusing on, well, who do we really want to focus around? What's our target market? And collectively, and who do we serve well? And collectively, like there's a lot of people that we can serve, and there's a lot of events and organizers. But if we had to use marketing dollars or write content or really focus towards one vertical, conferences is what we're looking at. We really enjoy conferences. It's generally because with conferences, it's a sharing of not just bringing people together, but it's a sharing of ideas and, mm-hmm. and new creativity and spark. And from our standpoint, it's like, that's really neat. Not only, you know, again, do we get to create, you know, relationships and or help create those relationships and gathering of people in terms of, you know, kinship, but when you can go out there and create new ideas or help create new ideas or create that forum, we really gravitate to that. So that's really what we are focusing on is conferences and really helping spark creative ideas.
Super. Now you started pretty small. You've grown, as you put it to me, bigger. Like, you always challenge me to think bigger.
Mm-hmm.
How big are you now, and how big do you think Picketing can get?
Well, I mean, big is all relative in terms of how you think. I mean, our whole big thing was when we first started, we were in Canada, and then how to expand to the U.S. and then now in North America, Europe, Australia, Switzerland, Sweden, New Zealand last week. I mean, it's just growing all over. So how big can we get? And we are in every English speaking country in the world right now, I believe. We'd love to go out there and translate our software to non-English speaking cultures, communities, and countries. We get a lot of questions around that, but when you start doing language, it gets a little bit tricky. So that is where we like to see where we're going. The API side on the business to business side is a really, really exciting piece of our business. There's some fantastic, really, really strong partners that are coming on board on that side. In terms of people, we're at 18 people. I think what we will do is we'll double up this year in size. I suspect that'll happen as we grow up the marketing and sales side. What we do is we're really particular in terms of who we hire, and so we really look to get senior people in place so that the 18 are very, very strong. So and then, you know, from a revenue standpoint, I mean, it's the numbers are fantastic and they're growing. So it's a whole bunch of levers. And the question going back to how big can you get, there's nothing stopping us. I mean, the way we look at it, and our goal is to have every single person in this world use our platform in one way or another, be it on the consumer side or the API side. So that is it. I mean,
that's pretty big.
That is big. Every single person in this world.
Okay. Now, so you're, the last time I was in your offices, I'm not sure how many people you had. You certainly didn't have 18. What are the kind of spin-offs that are happening in the you're located in Gastown. I know you've got some satellite, at least one satellite worker. I don't know how many more. What are some of the positive spin-offs for the Vancouver community? You guys came out of Saskatoon.
Yeah.
I know you've got some kind of presence, or you had some presence on the island. what impact is Piketik having on these economies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what ends up happening is when you start bringing in, we've been able to attract talent from different parts of the world. So, and really strong talent, which gives us an opportunity to really have a diverse crew. So, you know, in terms of the taxonomy of our talent, we have people from Australia, we have people from Brazil, we have people from China, we have some from the United States, all over parts of Canada, one from Belarus. So when we can go out there and employ talent with different backgrounds, and keep them and retain them within our own backyard, that is great. And then what they do is they start spinning off and doing different things that add value to the community. So, for example, one of our guys has the biggest React meetup in Canada. So they're adding value back into the community. Another one, because we have such a strong partnership with Google, it speaks to the community about our experiences working with Google infrastructure. And so like there's, and this is happening in so many different instances where, because we are events, we love to share and we love to give back to the community, is that this thought leadership is really going back and engaging the community and hopefully lifting the community. And when tides rise, boats rise, sort of ideology. So there is that. We bring in a lot of people in order to do events. So we'll bring in people from the Valley and do some mind share and create opportunities for engagement and really learning from others. So there's that piece. I myself speak whenever I can, if there's an opportunity and people are interested in learning potentially, or if I feel that there's some value that I can give from all the years and the different startup communities that I've been in. So those are just a few examples. I'm sure that there's a million more that really help the community. And then again, the next thing too is we're paying taxes in our own backyard and carrying those moments and bringing in new investment dollars and creating a little spark in the economy. So, you know, collectively, all these startups and all these tech companies are really helping.
Super. Now, can you just tell us where we can find you online, and then we're going to take a break and then start the next section.
Absolutely. It's Pick a Ticket. It's abbreviated for Pick a Ticket. It's at PICATIC.com.
Okay, great. So like I said, we'll take a short break here, Jayesh, and we'll get right back to talk about you as an entrepreneur. Thanks. Thanks for listening to this episode of Lift Podcasts, a series all about the entrepreneurs, creatives, and resource people who are growing local businesses. If you liked what you heard, please share via email or social media. And if you are sharing via social media, please use Vancouver Island's talent brand or talent tag, hashtag WEARE VANISL. That's hashtag We Are Van Isle. This is one of the tools we've created to promote entrepreneurs on the island. Lyft is able to do its work thanks to the support of solution sponsors like SureCopy Courtney, Mastermind Strategy, 50th Parallel Public Relations, Finneron Hyundai, Jabin Postal Films, Presley and Partners, and 98.9 The Goat, as well as community partners like Atlas Cafe, The Island Word, My Tech Guys, McKinnon Photography, Island Soul Films, Investors Group, The Creator Space, and Douglas Magazine. Together, we're making shift happen for local businesses. Thanks for listening.